Last night's episode of Frontline on PBS Wisconsin lays bare the roots of the misinformation that has built a movement directly impacting Wisconsin and threatening to undermine our representative republic. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Kate Archer-Kent, and our guests are the reporter and the filmmaker behind last night's episode, Plot to Overturn the Election. From the Frontline documentary, here is Rudy Giuliani leaving a message for a Republican elected official in Maricopa County, Arizona.
Bill, it's Rudy Giuliani, President Trump's lawyer. If you get a chance, would you please give me a call? I have a few things I'd like to talk over with you. Maybe we can get this thing fixed up. You know, I really think it's a shame that Republicans sort of were both in this kind of situation. And I think there may be a nice way to resolve this for everybody. So give me a call, Bill. I'm on this number anytime. Doesn't matter. Okay? Take care. Bye.
If you saw it, what did you think? And what would you like to know about the work that went into uncovering the plot and the characters responsible for continuing to perpetuate disproven allegations and vague insinuations about the 2020 presidential election outcome? Join us at 1-800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Our guest, ProPublica reporter A.C. Thompson, joins us. A.C., good morning.
Good morning.
As well as documentary filmmaker and the director of this episode of Frontline, Samuel Black. Samuel, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having us, Lee.
I'm going to start just with the news of the last week or so, and I would love to get both of your reactions to it. The 29 texts from Ginny Thomas, the wife of Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas, to Mark Meadows, then Chief of Staff for the White House, between November 2020 and January 2021. And then the reporting yesterday from Bob Woodward and Robert Costa in the Washington Post on 7-plus hours of missing call logs from the White House on January 6th. AC, how did that fit into what you were working on in last night's episode?
It fit in when those stories started coming out. Honestly, Samuel and I were worried that our bosses were going to say, "Oh my gosh, we need to add this to the film. This takes things in a new direction." But luckily, they didn't. But the thing is, I think what the Ginny Thomas messages to Mark Meadows are sort of emblematic of the way that a lot of people in the Republican establishment were supportive and remain supportive of President Trump's false claims. And I think that's the thing that really ties it into our film is that these people who really ought to know better and are in positions of power are, you know, have been supportive of this basically attempt to reverse the election from the jump.
Samuel Black, what was your takeaway from the news of the last few days?
Yeah, one thing that was interesting about that, and as AC says, it wasn't directly connected to the story we're telling, but when you look at what Ginny Thomas was texting to Mark Meadows at the time in those weeks and months after the election, she was pushing, she was excited about the fact that Sidney Powell, who was one of the lawyers initially on Trump's team, and who was General Michael Flynn's personal attorney. She was excited about the fact that Sidney Powell was pushing these conspiracy theories about Dominion voting and was challenging Trump's loss in several states. And that is an element of the story that's at the heart of what we cover in our film. Powell was a key figure who gained notoriety for her press conference she gave on November 19th when she stood up and made wild, outlandish claims about a conspiracy to rig the vote. But what our film shows is she was part of a larger network of people, including the former General Michael Flynn and others, who have played an outsized role in seeding the country with misinformation about the election.
AC, last night's episode of Frontline, Plot to Overturn the Election, takes you to a small northern Michigan, Antrim County, Michigan, where some of this conspiracy begins to evolve surrounding Dominion voting machines. But really, it's, as you detail, a human error that seems to start this snowball rolling. Tell us a little bit about going to this place in Michigan and how this story begins to unfold for you.
Right. You know, I honestly didn't expect to end up in rural northern Michigan in Antrim County to chase down this story. But it turns out that that place has a key role in all of this. You know, so basically, on election night, Antrim County seemed to be showing that that Biden was winning the popular vote there. And that was a big surprise to people because it's a heavily Republican area. And that was a product of basically a mistake on the part of the clerk, not updating her systems enough to properly tabulate the votes. And the next morning, she realized that. Her name's Cheryl Guy. She's the county clerk. And they retabulated, and got to the right number. And she was transparent about everything that happened. But for people who were looking for a way to say, hey, there was something wrong with the vote, President Trump should still be in office, he should have won, they seized on this mistake in Antrim County as proof that there was some sort of malfeasance at work, that there was some sort of plot to get rid of Trump. And they realized that, oh, the company that's providing the voting technology here is this company called Dominion Voting Services. They go to the county twice and inspect the voting machines and then generate this completely erroneous report, basically saying that the machines themselves were engineered to perpetuate fraud. The people behind this were a Dallas-based company called Allied Security Operations Group, which we learned would play a huge role in the mythology around the stolen election. But they were tied in with this broader network of people, Sidney Powell, Lynn Wood, who is a conservative attorney down in South Carolina, who hosted many of these activists on his plantation, Michael Flynn, Patrick Byrne, the former CEO of Overstock.com, paid for this group to do its work and to fly into Antrim County. So what you see in Antrim County, a mythology, a bogus idea that ends up being spread by the president, then President Donald Trump, that is part of a broader was generated by a broader group of people.
That's A.C. Thompson, investigative reporter for ProPublica. You saw him in front of the screen last night if you saw the latest Frontline episode, Plot to Overturn the Election. And Samuel Black joining us, director of last night's episode on PBS Wisconsin. Samuel, you've done other Frontline episodes about WikiLeaks, about Kamal Khashoggi. What drew you to this story about the election results?
Well, thank you for asking. Actually, those films that you referenced were for other networks and other distributors. This is actually my first Frontline film.
Oh,
so it was a real honor to work with Frontline and ProPublica on this. But I was really drawn to this story because we're in unfortunately a unique political moment in the United States right now, where we have polls show that over two-thirds of Republicans now consider Biden's election illegitimate. And that represents a real challenge to Democratic legitimacy. And so we had seen that happen. We had seen the events of January 6th. But the question was, would the events of January 6th be a nail in the coffin for this movement that we've seen questioning the election, or would it continue? And it became clear over the course of the beginning of 2021 that movement was only continuing. It was hard for anything to stop it, no matter how many times the facts were debunked. The myth of the stolen election had a way of growing, metastasizing, and absorbing new speculations about the election, and ignoring inconvenient truths about the fact that the election was by and large free and fair and didn't have any fraud that would have changed the outcome in any state. So and then it was really just my luck to be able to team up with AC and the whole team at ProPublica, who had been digging into this story as well, and had as AC mentioned, located some of the key origins of this in this group that met at Linwood's plantation in the weeks after the election. So that's really where the story came from.
Beyond facts, creating myth and believing that myth in, without any substantive actual details or data. Our guest, Samuel Black, the director of last night's episode of Frontline, Plot to Overturn the Election, A.C. Thompson, the reporter for ProPublica. And if you have questions for them, 1-800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Our conversation continues on The Morning Show. This is the Ideas Network. The plot to overturn the election was laid bare in last night's episode of Frontline on PBS Wisconsin. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and we're joined by the reporter and filmmaker responsible for the hour-long documentary, which you can now stream at pbswisconsin.org. Here's A.C. Thompson interviewing the former CEO of Overstock.com, Patrick Byrne.
Out of all the people I've met, you seem to be the person most personally responsible for motivating this election fraud movement. And some would say for spreading disinformation. And do you think that's an accurate way that you are sort of the kingpin?
Well, or that I'm the one who's waking up Americans to this deep problem in our election apparatus.
Let me ask you if you agree to this simple binary. If you're right, you're saving the country. If you're wrong, you're destroying it.
Yep. I can live with that.
So what would you like to know about what Frontline and ProPublica left on the cutting room floor after last night's episode? And what would you like to see them focus on next? 1-800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. A.C. Thompson joins us along with the director of last night's episode of Frontline, Samuel Black. And what was your takeaway, A.C., from Patrick Byrne, the former CEO of Overstock.com?
You know, I think Patrick is a very, very smart guy. I think that he believes these theories sincerely, and that he's poured a huge amount of money into this effort, that this is to him his life's calling. But when he lays out his evidence, and Samuel and I went to a big presentation he gave, a PowerPoint presentation he gave to a huge audience. We interviewed him for multiple hours. We read his book, we watched his film. The evidence is just simply not compelling. It's not evident. It's a collection of unrelated facts woven together with a narrative that he wants to believe.
And that narrative, there are a lot of believers, as you pointed out, according to one poll from last year, 2/3 of Republicans buy into this. And, you know, as journalists, you do check your confirmation bias. But Samuel, from your perspective, how much of this is just reinforced from the folks around where these true believers live?
Well, I think what we found is that there's an ecosystem of conservative or right-wing media that does reinforce these ideas. And it's not as much Fox News or some of the channels that people might be more familiar with. It's gone beyond that. It's channels like One American News Network, Newsmax. And then beyond television, it's people following political operatives and politicians on social media, like on Telegram, and so we really delved into those worlds because we wanted to, in addition to looking at the origins of the myth, we wanted to cover how the myth has motivated a movement that is trying to change how elections are run in this country. And so in order to cover that movement, you had to find the channels they're using to communicate. And it really was in these alternative forms of social media. There's almost a whole alternative infrastructure instead of YouTube, these folks are on Rumble. As I said, instead of Twitter, these folks are on Telegram. And because of that kind of isolation, it can feel like an echo chamber full of what ultimately turn out to be false claims, misleading narratives about the election and other things. In the film, we go to rallies in Michigan, Georgia. We also covered the release of an audit in Maricopa County, Arizona. And at those rallies, you really do get a sense that the activity that you see online does translate into protest in the real world.
That's Samuel Black. He was the director of last night's episode of Frontline, Plot to Overturn the Election. In front of the camera was a reporter for ProPublica, A.C. Thompson, joining us, as you are invited to join us as well at 1-800-642-1234, where Peter joins us from Iowa. Peter, good morning.
Hi, good morning. I have a question about the results that this gentleman came up with. He worked for President Trump, but he's now released a study.
Who is this?
Where he, I can't remember the fellow's name, but he has a website called crimeresearch.org. I think his name is Knott.
John Lott. K-N-O. John Lott, I believe.
Lott. Yeah. So yeah, exactly. That's his name. What do we say to that? The stuff that he comes up with about the precinct data, where you have like essentially the same neighborhood. And it just comes out to be in a different county, but they're precincts because they're very small precincts. And then one precinct had just dramatically higher levels of votes.
According to John Lott and his research.
His research.
I was familiar, I believe, with John Lott's argument from some time ago about more guns, less crime, and the questions about data that were included there. Do either of you, AC or Samuel, know anything about crimeresearch.org or the work that John Lott had done there?
No, that's one I'm not familiar with. Sam, are you up on that?
No, I'm not familiar with that either. I mean, from what you're saying, it sounds like he sounds like one of the people that has tried to look at anomalies in historical voting data. Is that correct?
Well, the conclusion from the study is says the estimates of Arizona, Georgia, Michigan, Nevada, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin combined indicate an average of 255,000 excess votes for Biden, but that's coming from John Lott at crimeresearch.org. But there are a number of these, and we've seen this recently in Wisconsin about some cell phone data and how that ties into cell towers, libraries, and ballot box drop boxes in Wisconsin, because we have our own special counsel here investigating the election results for president here in Wisconsin. So I'd be interested in knowing from either of you what you know about what's happening here in our backyard.
Yeah, there's I'm not familiar with John Lott, but that does sound like he sounds like one of several people who've been looking at historical data and frankly making claims that just don't hold up to scrutiny about, you know, they're just sort of the general claims about, you know, more people voted in this county than ever. Is it more people voted in this state than any year since X, Y, and Z? Another person that there's a group of people who've done this. One of the people who's been traveling the country making these claims is a man named Seth Keschel, who was actually at Linwood's plantation during this period. We didn't have time to cover him and his work in the film, it's difficult to speak with specificity when asked about such a general question. But I think people should really take this stuff with a grain of salt. You know, there's been efforts across the country to find fraud. And they've been very well funded, as we document in our film, and none of them has found anything that's anything like real evidence that the election was rigged or fraudulent in any way.
I'm sorry, we're just out of time, but I've got so many more questions to go. But I want to thank you for your work. I want to invite folks to watch the latest episode of Frontline, Plot to Overturn the Election, which is now available on demand, and you can stream from PBS Wisconsin. A.C. Thompson, thank you so much. And Samuel Black, thank you as well.
Thank you.
A.C. Thompson's the investigative reporter for ProPublica, and Samuel Black, the director from last night's episode of Frontline, Plot to Overturn the Election. Up next is news and a story of our Wisconsin life. Then we talk about the threat of our overflowing sewer systems and what that means to our lakes, both great and small. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Kate Archer Kent, and coming up, the president of the Alliance for the Great Lakes. But first, it's time for Wisconsin Life, and here's producer Brad Kohlberg with a story about saving a life by doing your job.
When we're at work, we all have a number of roles. We can take on other jobs, wear several hats. Albert Watson is a detention officer at the Dane County Juvenile Detention Center, where he also hosts a cooking club. Here, he tells the story of the day he saved a life by taking a bit of his own advice.
I had 10 minutes left of my shift before it was time to go home. I was headed to the control room to relinquish my equipment when the timer went off. I informed my coworker, Walter, that I'd head back to the pod to check on the male youth. See, every 25 minutes, our policy is to check on every kid that's in their room. This was the kid whose mood seemed to change as the day went on. It seemed like the more people he talked to, whether it be his social worker, public defender, the police, the more emotional he became. I've been a detention officer for almost 10 years at the Dane County Juvenile Detention Center. I've been training for a lead worker position and recently became the president of the Wisconsin Juvenile Detention Association. For the past 5 years, I've facilitated a cooking group at detention. No, I have not been to culinary school. My passion for cooking started with my dad. I'm the oldest of four boys, and my dad would get us up at 6:30 a.m. just so we could eat breakfast, consisting of sausage, salt pork, homemade biscuits, eggs, and tomato gravy. Yeah, I'm crunching in the sugar sandwich. My dad could take some neck bones and barbecue them in the oven and make us licking our fingers shortly after engaging that dish. So when I cook with these kids, it's from the heart and with love. We made many dishes over the last 5 years, from deep fried Twinkies and Oreos to fried chicken and waffles. We've done homemade meatloaf, five cheese macaroni, lasagna and homemade garlic bread, patty melts, paninis. We always like to celebrate other cultures. So during the month of March, giving respect to the Irish, we did corned beef and cabbage, shamrock shakes, and bangers and mash, which isn't really an Irish dish, but was one of the recipes that popped up when I Googled Irish dishes. Well, I can't forget the Kool-Aid. Kool-Aid is special when you're locked up. I bet y'all wondering, what do the kids get when they don't earn the lunch? They get hot dogs. Hot dogs I boil for about 4 hours. All I do is keep adding water to them. These turkey franks go from looking light brown color to this pale off-white spongy Vienna sausage frank. I once added green food coloring on St. Patrick's Day. I'm a damn fool at work. Some people think it's mean or cruel. I call it get your together. I can't reward negative behavior. You can't disrespect staff or be verbally abusive and earn the lunch. You can't steal a car on Wednesday night, get locked up, and earn the special lunch on Thursday. We'll shoot for next Thursday. The point I'm trying to make is, do your job. A kid that's incarcerated has only one job, and that's to follow the program so you can get the hell up out of detention. As I entered B-Pod, I walked to a room, B3. As I opened a small window of B3, I wasn't sure if what I was seeing was real, but it was. The male youth was hanging from the side of his toilet sink. I radioed for staff to call 911 and ask for assistance in B-Pod. I then opened the door of B3 and entered. Walter had just arrived. I instructed Walter to open the first aid drawer and grab the scissors from the first aid kit. You know, once I had the scissors in my hand, I began cutting the part of the sheet that was wrapped around this kid's neck. The kid let out this grunt of a sound, which let me know that he just might be okay. I gently placed this kid on the floor and wrapped several blankets on him to make him as comfortable as I could. continue to talk to him and assure him that he was going to be okay. The point I'm trying to make is that I was doing my job that day. That timer went off after 25 minutes and that kid needed to be checked. A good thing happened from doing my job, and that's what I try to teach these kids during their short stay, the Dade County Juvenile Detention Center.
Albert Watson's story came to us from the podcast Inside Stories, which features Madison storytellers and digs deeper into their lives. He's a detention officer at the Dane County Juvenile Detention Center and just finished his term as president of the Wisconsin Juvenile Detention Association. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Brad Kohlberg.
Now, here's something to think about. According to research from the University of Michigan, the total annual precipitation in the Great Lakes region has increased by 14% over the last 60-plus years, and the amount of rainfall from our heaviest storms has grown by 35%. We're getting wetter around here, and the results, as you are likely aware, have been flooding in our communities and pollution in our waterways. The climate's changing, and our infrastructure struggle to adapt, but potential solutions are available. Are they affordable? And what are the real costs of continuing with our outdated and aging sewer systems? Join us, 1-800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. Our guest is Joel Brummeyer. He's the president of the Alliance for the Great Lakes. Joel, good to talk to you.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us. And I want to start just with an explanation for combined sewage systems. It's more than 40% of the United States combined sewage systems are found right here in the Midwest. Give us some idea of how they work and why they can be a problem.
Yeah, it's a technical term, but it's pretty simple, right? A combined sewage system is just a pipe that gathers everything from your house, from a business, off the street, when it rains, and puts it all into the same pipe. And eventually that water either goes to a place where it gets treated and discharged after it's been cleaned, or it gets dumped into a river or a lake because there's nowhere else to put it. And so combined sewer systems is a way a lot of the Midwest cities were built. And of course, we're still dealing with the consequences of that today.
And where do we find these combined sewer systems around the Great Lakes? Are they still very common?
They are. There are about 150 permitted combined sewer systems in the Great Lakes region. Now, not all of those have sewage overflows frequently. In fact, the number of overflows has reduced dramatically, especially over the last 20 years. But it's still a common practice in the Great Lakes region and in the Northeast.
Earlier this year, we spoke with Ashland Mayor Deb Lewis, who identified the city sewer system as one of her worries.
The sewer overflows have become a chronic problem in the last several years. Not frequent, but one is too many.
A chronic problem where one can be too many, Joel. What's the scope of this problem across the Midwest?
Well, combined sewer overflows, it used to be that it was just the default. When it rained, you would dump combined sewage into the water and be done with it, and hopefully people's basements wouldn't back up, right? Because these are all part of the same system. Today, what we're seeing is a lot of those smaller overflows have been reduced, but we're seeing that the systems, these massive systems that are built throughout Great Lakes cities, really can't keep up with the level of rainfall that's hitting the ground. And so remember, the combined sewers mean that whatever hits the ground when it rains goes into the same pipe as what's coming out of your house. The volume of water in some of these massive storms that we've seen, of course, record rainfalls in year after year in Wisconsin, the systems just can't keep up with it. And so what you end up with is maybe a lot of those smaller sewage overflows have been reduced or eliminated, but these systems can't cope with these massive record rainfalls. And you see big events, big dumping of combined sewage into Lake Michigan, or even as we just heard, Lake Superior in places where it really wasn't a huge problem until recently.
But the cost, Joel, sewage systems can take millions of dollars to update. On the other hand, who bears the financial burdens of sewage systems that haven't been updated and are failing?
Yeah, so, water infrastructure is the thing that you don't see because it's all buried, but it really is the circulatory system of a thriving community, right? So the cost to actually eliminate CSOs can be very high. The cost to virtually eliminate that, meaning, you know, eliminate all but a few, can be more reasonable. Getting those last couple of CSOs eliminated can be very expensive, even though, for example, Milwaukee's sewage district has set the goal of zero CSOs, which I think is really laudable. The cost has historically, it started in the 70s, the federal government invested a lot in constructing these new sewage systems to manage this pollution, to dramatically reduce it, comply with the Clean Water Act. That grant money went away in the late 80s, and we've seen it come roaring back as of this year in the form of new federal investment in water infrastructure, the Federal Infrastructure Act. And that's actually pumping more new construction money into these systems. In that interim time, though, communities were on the hook for paying for these improvements. And so you had a lot, you know, communities large and small, urban and rural, shelling out tens of millions, in some cases hundreds of millions or billions of dollars to continue to rebuild their sewage systems. And frankly, that, you know, that fell on the backs of some communities and some people who couldn't afford it. And so we saw a lot of delays in the control of that pollution. And I'm glad to see the new federal investment coming in that's going to help a lot of these communities catch up to where we need to be for clean water.
Our guest, the president of the Alliance for the Great Lakes, Joel Brunmeier. And I'll ask you if you've noticed more rain where you live, and how long does the rain stick around in ditches on streets? Does your town or city sewer system constantly flood? And how does that affect your home, your basement? And are you worried about flooding and whether or not it'll get worse as time goes on? Join us at 1-800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. And Joel, as you lead this organization that advocates for the Great Lakes, when sewage systems overflow, how are the lakes affected?
Yeah, so there's some sort of short-term and long-term effects. Short-term, everybody sees the big plume of pollution going out into the lake or into your local river, and that means you can't swim. It means you might have a drinking water advisory, you know, for a day or two. You're probably not going to take a boat out. So there's impacts on that local recreation, the local economy that's supported by recreation when you have a local overflow. There are longer term impacts too, though. You know, for example, one of the biggest challenges, if maybe the biggest challenge in the Great Lakes right now, is with nutrient pollution that feeds these massive algae blooms. And so one source of nutrients, things like phosphorus and nitrogen, is actually sewage. And so that adds to the load of nutrients that are overloading parts of the Great Lakes, like Green Bay, like Lake Erie. So there are short and long-term effects from these combined sewer overflows. And I think that the bottom line is people rightly feel we can do better, right? We don't need to dump our waste, our sewage into the open water in 2022.
Joel Brunmeier, our guest, he is the president of the Alliance for the Great Lakes, and we are taking a look at the infrastructure beneath our feet, the federal infrastructure funding that makes available the opportunity to update into the 21st century. And if you have a question about what takes place beneath our feet and our infrastructure and what's next in the 21st century, join us at 1-800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. I'm Lee Rayburn, and we'll continue the conversation here on The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Sewer socialism? In the early 20th century, according to the Wisconsin Historical Society, when socialists in Milwaukee tried to respond to the pollution of the Industrial Revolution by supporting new sanitation systems and municipal water supplies, they were called sewer socialists, and it was not considered a compliment. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and we're looking at what it takes to build a 21st century sewer system with our guest, the president of the Alliance for the Great Lakes, Joel Brunmeier. And if you've got a question, join us at 1-800-642-1234. If you live near a lake or a river and you've seen this runoff, tell us how it's affected you. And Joel, as I understand it, one third of Milwaukee is currently serviced by a combined sewer system, CSO, as you referred to it. And as you also talk about, the city of Milwaukee is shooting for a goal of zero overflows into our waterways. As we start to look at solutions here, what approach is the city taking to combat overflows where they think they can reach that goal?
Yeah, I love that comment about the sewer socialism, and then there was the sewer wars in the 90s. And those scenarios played out in other cities in the Great Lakes, too, because as you said earlier, these are expensive projects. But if they are, one thing that's clear is that, you know, water is collective, right? We're all in this together, whatever your political stripes are. And so I have been impressed with some of the ways that Milwaukee has approached trying to solve this problem. You know, a couple of innovative things. One is they're actually buying and managing land in upper parts of watersheds, so further away from downtown Milwaukee, to enhance water quality and reduce the volume of water that's going into the rivers upstream, which helps address water quality and flood risk downstream, right? A really innovative approach. They're also looking at how they're bringing private financing into addressing building green infrastructure with community benefits. So green infrastructure, you know, instead of building pipes and big holes in the ground, green infrastructure kind of absorbs some of that rainfall before it even gets to the sewer system. So it creates more space within this combined sewer, that so it doesn't overflow into people's basements as quickly, doesn't overflow into the lake as quickly. And that's all part of this idea that they could get to a zero CSO outcome, which is really cool.
Is green infrastructure, is this a sort of a shift in how we understand our infrastructure and our collective, where we're all in this together and we have to share this water? And if so, how does green infrastructure change the way you see our infrastructure, Joel?
Well, in a lot of Midwest cities, you can't use concrete and holes in the ground that are big enough to solve this problem. You've got to find a way to capture some of this water where it comes down on the ground. And that's where green infrastructure comes in. So I think that the thing about green infrastructure is that it allows water to come to hit the ground. And instead of going into a sewer system, it could support a growing wetland, or it could, you know, percolate into the groundwater instead of going into a pipe. These are solutions that need to be integrated into what I would call, you know, the more 20th century gray infrastructure approach. But we got to do so at a scale that's way beyond what we've been doing, right? So as we've discussed today, the rainfall coming and hitting Midwest cities is increasing dramatically. It's getting dumped in more extreme amounts. Our sewer systems, stormwater systems, aren't up to the task of dealing with that. And we're facing the reality of a changing climate. And that has effects way beyond sewer systems. But green infrastructure can actually provide a host of benefits to cities, to rural areas, that goes way beyond just absorbing water. And that's what makes it a good investment. We're hopeful that we see set-asides for investment in green infrastructure through a lot of these billions of infrastructure dollars that are coming to the states. And, you know, the state of Wisconsin is going to have a big role to play in making those decisions, along with local communities like Milwaukee.
Well, and let me ask you about some of the smaller communities around the Great Lakes and throughout Wisconsin. And we touched on the solutions Milwaukee's exploring. But Joel, the EPA says most towns with our combined sewer systems combined sewer problems have fewer than 10,000 people in. So as you look from a small town perspective, what can they do to climate proof their infrastructure?
Yeah, so affordability of solving this problem has been a huge issue for cities large and small. And so in rural, smaller communities, it can be very challenging to solve these problems in a way that's affordable for residents. And so it's really critical that the federal funding coming in to these places is geared toward dealing with that affordability problem, both in terms of getting construction grants out so communities can take on some of these innovative solutions. Like Milwaukee might be showing the way, but a community of 10,000 people, you know, may not have the resources to do that on their own. And so, you know, getting the funds in place so they can follow that example is one thing. Another is that, you know, EPA really, and the states especially, really need to revise their approach to how they distribute funds. And so making sure that the funds go to the places where the need is greatest, where the affordability is lowest, and you're actually, you know, using these funds to intervene in cities and towns and rural areas and urban neighborhoods where, you know, ratepayers simply aren't going to be able to afford to pay the full cost of getting to clean water. And that's why, you know, we're all in this together. And it's great to see these problems starting to get solved, you know, across the Great Lakes region.
Let's go to your calls and questions now at 1-800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Our guest is the president of the Alliance for the Great Lakes, Joel Brummeyer. And Jeff from Delafield, you're on the air. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. My question is in regards to tiling of farm fields. We see much greater use of the plastic tiles in almost every farm field now, and I believe that's to get the water off the fields faster. Isn't that counter to everything you're talking about in terms of having green infrastructure where the water can soak into the ground? And if so, why do we allow so much of that to go on? Thank you.
And thank you, Jeff. The plastic sheeting we see at farms, not something I remember seeing at farms as a kid. Joel, what impact does that have?
So tile drains on farms can be a hotline for pollution into our waters. And so it's true that they're there to get the water off as quickly as possible. If that water contains excess nutrients, phosphorus, nitrogen, which comes from chemical fertilizers and manure, it can feed these algae blooms, some of which can become toxic. So it's important that we do look at our whole watersheds, the whole area where the rain falls, as a single system, right? And so keeping dirty water out of our rivers, out of the lakes, is important no matter where you are. And so if it's critical to update agricultural practices, so the fertilizer that's being put on the ground isn't going into surface waters either, right? That's possible. There's practices and tools and techniques that we know how to do that. The challenge is that we've got to make sure that's being actually applied to land, across these big watersheds, and that we've got the right regulations and the right funding in place. And that can be a big challenge with farming.
Joel, what does, over the last couple of years, we've talked an awful lot about public health, but how does public health fit into our future of our sewer systems?
I think everybody's have heard a lot about, how we're tracking COVID, for example, through looking at pathogens, in sewer water, which is just a really innovative idea that I love to read about. Looking at the bigger picture, I see public health and lake health as being, joined at the hip, right? So combined sewer systems don't just put sewer water into Lake Michigan. They put it into people's homes. They put it into businesses. It causes, the flooding and property damage and that costs tens of millions or hundreds of millions of dollars when an extreme storm hits, right? So these are all aspects of public health. I think that the best way to a healthy Lake Michigan is to make sure that we're dealing with all aspects of how, people connect with water, and all the ways that they need to have healthy water in their lives every day. And so that means dealing with the whole system, right? Not just with the end of a pipe.
Joel, I want to thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
Joel Brummeyer is the president of the Alliance for the Great Lakes. Mental health professionals use a book called Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders to guide their assessments and treatments. Just ahead, we'll talk with two psychiatrists about what recent revisions to the book mean for people's everyday lives. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.